Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to AnCast. I'm Zach Burchy. Jacob is here.
As always.
We are, we're in for a special show this time. I didn't take any Twitter questions for this. We have a very special panel assembled here today. Joining us for today's show, it's, well, you read his column, House of a Thousand Manga, on Anime News Network. He's the creator of the Manga Cup board game, author of Manga the Complete Guide. Everyone knows this guy, Jason Thompson. Jason, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you for having me on. It's a real honor.
I mean, you've been on the show like three times.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a real honor.
I appreciate that.
To be with you guys and also to be on a panel with Erica, who I assume we will be introducing soon.
Yeah, spoilers.
Always awesome.
Spoilers. All right. Also on the panel, Erica Friedman, founder of YuriCon, Okazu. You can find her blogging at okazu.com. She is has a new book out, Absolute Power, lesbian supervillain anthology from Northwest Press. Erica, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
It is always a pleasure to be here, and it's really great to have this conversation and meet new people and speak to old friends about stuff I care about.
Yeah, so speaking of new people, we have a new panelist joining the show for the first time. Her name is Valerie Complex. You can find her on Twitter or at RottenTomatoes.com/critic/ValerieComplex. Valerie, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me. I've been a fan of ANN for a really long time, and I spend most of my time reviewing anime movies when I'm not watching mind-numbing action films. So, thank you for having me.
The best kind. Yeah,
yeah, right. So today's conversation is a doozy. We're going to talk here about LGBT representation in anime and manga. And just why don't we have – Jacob, can you tell us what people mean when they say representation? Jacob.
Oh, me. I thought you said Jason. No, that's going to be a thing.
Yeah, oh, that'll be a
second
thing.
Second syllable right. Kind of dictates two different... oh, right. What do people mean? Well, typically what people mean when they say representation in main manga, they mean the depiction of a character who is LGBT themselves in some way, or reminds, or even on a subtextual level, reminds LGBT people of something that they can specifically relate to, whether it be a struggle or a specific set of emotions or just an aesthetic. Ideally, representation is literal, is like concrete and like reinforced by the narrative. Is like, oh, this person is actually gay, or this person is actually transgender, or this person is, any number of things along that spectrum. But we may not always get that because not only because Japan is a little more conservative than the U.S. when it comes to this stuff, but also because Japanese culture is a little less direct in terms of the way that stuff is stated language-wise and romantically, especially when it comes to things like sexual desire. Like, the I guess the platonic ideal of these things sometimes is to not be as direct. Sometimes fans of romance and just storytelling in general kind of prefer it that way, almost. So representation gets to be a little bit of a sticky wicket, but that's generally what we mean.
A little bit, yes.
Yeah, and there's also the issue of marketing, too, because a lot of anime manga companies like to keep things as ambiguous as possible so that they sell to the most amount of people as possible.
Yeah.
Well, that's true of the West, certainly, as well.
That's true.
That's an economic
decision. The maximum amount of shipping possibilities, yeah.
Yeah, totally. So what I wanted to start this conversation with was if you could share a little bit about yourself and the first time you saw LGBT representation in anime and you responded to it either positively or negatively, like whether or not it struck you as good or particularly bad, mm-hmm. like when's the first time you noticed it in something? Actually, Erica, why don't we start with you on that?
Nobody's going to be surprised, and probably the entirety of the listening audience will roll their eyes when I say Sailor Moon.
No.
I know. It's a shock, right? I only write about it pretty much once a week, every week for the last 15 years.
Yeah.
Well, but the answer was I was a comics fan. I was an American comics fan since I was 7 years old, and I had this massive comics collection and had always been really interested in comics and animation. Haruka Michiru would come out on the screen, and, well, it was particularly Haruka who spoke with a voice that really blew me away, and I thought, wow, this is an amazing character, and then, of course, they were perfect and fabulous, and that pretty much was the moment. Like, I went, oh, you know, I was already in a relationship with my wife at the time. We'd been together for some years, but I'd never seen anything like that, and it absolutely, it stopped my heart, and that was it. And so from that point on, I guess the next step was Revolution Girl Utena. And then at that point, it just sort of went on from there. And that's pretty much the whole story of the birth of Yuri-Con from that point on.
Wow. Interesting. So, Jason, do you have a story like this?
Yeah, kind of. So I got into anime in college in the mid-1990s. And the first anime that I ever saw in my life, literally, was one which as often is the case in anime and manga, is sort of a very, very borderline and questionably LGBT themed. But that was Ranma ½. And that is the series which is all the characters are martial artists, but they change form, and the primary character basically shifts form between male and female, so it's basically got a lot of gender play. As so often is the case with these kinds of shows, and it's ultimately very heteronormative, and you know, he's always saying stuff like, oh, I'm really a guy, stop hitting on me and stuff like that, you know? Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I mean, it was really not like anything that I'd ever seen. And it had left a much stronger impression on me than the sort of science fiction and mecha kind of shows that were more like the kind of stuff that I'd seen in the West. From that, I started discovering other anime and manga that had more of that played with gender in other ways, like The Rose of Versailles, for one. In general, I identified as asexual at the time, and the depiction of, sexuality in anime and manga was also really... It was really a breath of fresh air to me compared to how it felt in Western fiction. Although that's a little harder to explain, I guess. But it was definitely the series that related, that had some sort of a gender play component that I really was struck by. And of course, whether that is in any sense legitimately LGBTQ is questionable, but. But it really felt that way to me at the time.
You know, I just finished a lecture out at the University of Michigan where I basically was talking about how that series was one of the primary keys for a lot of Western fans. And I remember being on Usenet when that was out and it was popular, and how people were talking about like things that they had never considered before, and maybe things in themselves that they had never realized before. And I remember the conversations that were going on, and I would actually call Ranma ½ one of the absolute gateways to the eventual appeal and success of Yuri and BL and gay manga genres here in the West.
Oh, that's an interesting connection.
Yeah, I feel it's, I feel that, and also now this stuff is often... This is getting away from the theme, but also the just depiction of romance and the depiction of romance in shoujo manga and some of the better shonen romantic manga that's not too sleazy was really an eye opener to me. I feel that the fandom of which I came out of was like science fiction and gaming fandom, which at the time, and comics fandom, which at the time was much more male dominated and had kind of this sort of hard masculine kind of, you know, feels, you know, where if where there wasn't any sexuality, or if it was, it was straight and it was really explicit and sort of predatory, you know.
Right. Yeah. Makes sense.
As I say, if you think that choice is questionable, mine's definitely questionable in terms of actual representation versus what it stuck out to me as. But because my pick would be Pokemon, actually, which I just wrote about. Right, which I just wrote about, which is not literal representation, but bear with me.
I will. Waiting.
Right. I just wrote about this for the site like today, basically. I mean, I didn't write it today. That would have taken a long. But it went up on site today. If you're talking about the very first interaction that I had with this kind of stuff, I would say that ironically, and maybe it's just because I watched a ton of it, but ironically, if you were a kid or an early teen and you lived in kind of a cloistered environment where not a lot of I grew up in a very conservative Christian household where a lot of other media was barred to you. Anime was kind of a sneaky way to see a lot of different ideas about gender and sexuality, and kind of continues to be. Like, there's stuff like, even though anime is way more conservative when it comes to directly stating, oh, this is a gay person, oh, this is, you know, this person is sort of a genderqueer kind of a thing. It's also more unique, I guess, in how it portrays some of this stuff, where I feel like there's a greater breadth of gender play in Japanese media than in gender ambiguity than there is in Western media, even for something simple that's like for kids. Because as a child, when I saw Pokemon, I hadn't really seen characters like Jesse and James before. Jesse is like very butch leader of the group, kind of forceful, I don't know, her personality, like, I knew I had a lot of lesbian friends growing up, and they would cite Jesse as, like, a sort of awakening character for them, which was odd for me, but then again, my favorite was James, and it was because James was, you know, he was a sissy, but he was, like, a really lovable sissy character, who was kind of admirable and fun, and, you know, I always look forward to seeing James. And, you know, they show up in every episode, like, usually in disguise as the opposite gender. Jesse is usually wearing, like a ringleader outfit. She has, like, a bullwhip and a, like, a matador costume or whatever that's, like, very male, and then James is in a tutu. And that was the thing every time. And it wasn't necessarily a joke. Like, there's never any point in the entire show where somebody says James is being girly or, like, gross or weird. Like, nobody ever makes fun of him for being effeminate. He's just extremely effeminate. So, when I got older, I look back on that as, like, oh, that was, like, kind of the early impetus for little me, because I was taught that, like, oh, being gay is a sin. Like, I was brought up in an extremely conservative, like, very anti-gay household. And so that was kind of an early window for me into, oh, no, but I like this character, and I like very effeminate men in a lot of different shows, and there's a lot of that in anime. So, you know, even though it wasn't direct representation, it was very meaningful for me, and it made it direct representation more palatable to me in stuff like Revolutionary Girl Utena and Gankutsuo the Count of Monte Cristo, which were some of my favorites after that, that had, like, very overtly LGBT characters. So, yeah.
I've just been watching the old Pokemon late at night when I can't sleep, and man, Jesse and James are awesome.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, they're really like worth watching. I hadn't realized how, like, I remember them because I was in my, I guess, my 20s or 30s when it was on originally, but so it was on TV, but I didn't really watch it. I love them. I could totally see what you're saying.
Oh, and on that note, Meowth, if you go back and you listen to the very first season, it's interesting to listen to, Meowth is actually played by a trans woman. And who transitioned while playing the role. Like, the credits change from her dead name to her new name. And yeah, and you can hear the portrayal of the character change because she was, you know, training her voice over time in the real world, and this affected how she played Meowth, because the Meowth's, like, pitch went up and became more effeminate as the character was being played. And it wasn't necessarily intentional. It was just sort of a result of you know, of basically what she was going through in real life. And, you know, she's rest in peace. She passed on a couple of years ago. But it's interesting to listen to, definitely.
That's fascinating. So, Valerie, can you share with us the first time you thought you saw, you know, decent or LGBT representation in anime and manga?
Well, first, I want to share a story, a real quick story about that. My very first LGBT experience in anime it crosses over with the very first anime I saw.
Oh, really?
Which was La Blue Girl, and I was 10 years old, and I was just getting into animation, and this is when anime was on Laserdisc, and I got tricked by some creep who was like, oh, this is like action, and it has all these different things in it, and I saw it, and I was horrified.
Right.
So I had to walk away from anime for a little bit, because I was like, I don't want to watch stuff like that as a kid. And then when I came back around to anime, the first thing I remember seeing that was like positive was Strawberry Panic from the early 1990s. And it was, you know, it reminded me of like Heathers, but like in Japan with all girls school, and everybody was, you know, everybody had either feelings for each other, or, you know, it was strictly sort of lesbian, queer girl sort of base. And I really enjoyed that, but I wanted to see the crossing over of, you know, maybe action and romance between LGBT characters. And then for me, that film was called Plastic Little. It's one shot.
Good one.
OVA that I saw that I had on Laserdisc, actually. And just the, you know, the action with the sort of, you know, subtle romance that was there between the two female characters was really positive for me and actually got me back into watching anime consistently. Probably dating myself, but yeah, that was like early 1990s. Like I said, when Laserdisc were popular, never quite took off. Those are sort of the positives for me, but I did have that one negative experience, which was unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Wow. That is a fascinating and in moments horrifying story, but that's really cool. I'm not going to talk about it too much, but I had a pretty healthy understanding of at the time, my mom was super progressive and like really pushed on us the idea that you are to, you know, LGBT folks are the same as everybody else. Love is love, blah, blah, blah. So I was pretty lucky in that regard. By the time I came to anime, I had a pretty healthy attitude about it already. But the first like 60 seconds of Utena blew my fucking mind apart.
Right.
Because it was like, I'm a girl and I'm a prince. Yeah. Fuck you. And I was like, that is the coolest fucking thing I have ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. This is so good. It opened my mind up to the idea of, no, really the same.
Right.
No, really, the same. And it's like, oh shit, the same.
Yeah.
And well, like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No. Utena really struck me. I think it's funny because people talk about Utena as majorly like, and it definitely is, as a sort of a lesbian awakening or a lesbian like, what's the word? Confirmation, I guess, or reassurance. Reassurance is maybe the word. For them at a younger age, if they saw it at a younger age. And for me, it wasn't a lesbian thing. It was, I didn't know it at the time, but it became very obvious over time. It was, I was really shocked by this girl who wanted to be a boy character. Like, very explicitly. It's not just, oh, she wants to take, like, agency in her own life. Like, Yeah, well, yeah. And, well, I didn't really fully understand what I was seeing, but it really, really spoke to me that she didn't care about gender and that she was, specifically, that she would wear men's clothes and stuff like that. And I, you know, obviously, a trans narrative wasn't necessarily what Ikuhara was getting at there, but he was getting at a gender doesn't matter or Utena doesn't realize that being female is a thing that will be held against her and that will be made expectations of her. She just, you know, all the things that she wants are traditionally male, which it was interesting. But yeah, like that part of the story really spoke to me. And I found that first 60 seconds where she is inspired by the prince to become a prince, to be exactly my feeling about all this, the media that I, the fairy tales that I grew up with, because I love fairy tales, but I was like, my fantasy prince wasn't like rescuing me in a dress. My fantasy prince was like going on an adventure with me. We were both princes, you know, like we were
two princes, you might
yeah,
say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh God, no,
two princes,
no.
Right. The thing with Utena is it really did one of everything, honestly. It did everything. So if you watched it, it didn't matter who you really were. There was some narrative somewhere in that. for you. We were joking about it at the time at Yuricon when it was really popular originally. We were joking about it how it was like high school on steroids, because no matter who you were, your story was portrayed somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. Were you the kind of girly artistic boy? Oh, there's Mickey. Oh, were you the, you know, was the horrible playboy who really traumatized you? Look, there's Toga. You know, was it an abusive relationship? There's Sionji. You know, like every character.
Were you tragic human garbage? Oh, Sionji.
And interesting how Utena is kind of a evolution of the Rose of Versailles from the classic manga from the 70s. I mean, Versailles, you know, it's set in the like French Revolution, so it's a period story. But, you know, and the main character is also a cross-dressing woman. And there's some, and arguably there's some, you know, there's some trans element in that. But it's, but nonetheless, for her, it's first off, it's not something she chose, right? It's, you know, she was raised as a boy. Her dad was like, oh, I need a son, so you will be my son. And it does lend itself to these, you know, I mean, it does lend itself to this her having this ambiguous gender presentation within society and being treated as, you know, as a man. But it's just interesting how that these themes, you know, evolve over time, and how Utena is kind of a you know, revivification of that.
I actually wrote an article about that, about the girl prince, how you can trace it from, like, you know, Sapphire from Ribbon no Kishi to Lady Oscar to Utena, and then through into the host, the kind of, when it became modified into a modern, like, the host cool characters like Haruka or like in Yaji Kida, you know, Kida's character Reiko is very cool, and she's this host character. So it sort of modulates over time, but the character never goes away. The girl prince continues.
Yeah.
Does anybody remember Princess Knight? Is it called Knight?
Mm-hmm. Ribbon no Kishi.
Yes.
Oh, that's what it is. That the Japanese?
Yeah, that's the Japanese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks,
I remember
Erica.
Seeing that a long time ago. This was before I saw some of Revolutionary Girl Utena. And I thought that it was pretty progressive, because I think that's from the 60s or the 70s or something. And they were playing with gender roles fairly early, earlier than anything they've ever done in American animation or films, really, for that matter. So the whole Versailles era is revolutionary in and of itself, because of the issues it deals with, not just, you know, gender, but talking about the revolution and things with
class
and bureaucracy and things like that. So I think anime has always been like super progressive in that way, but it seems like there's been sort of like a shift where you have a lot of positive influences. It seems like from the year 2000 and before, you can find a lot more things that look at those things positively. And I don't know if it's because of the shift in the, you know, world politics or whatever is happening, because I know Japanese anime has always been known to reflect sometimes what's going on in the world. But it seems like it's become a little bit more sort of negative in a sense. I don't know. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm just watching the wrong shit.
Well,
but
that was what I was mentioning earlier about sort of a difference. So people like, oh, well, Japan's more regressive when it comes to LGBT stuff than America is, which, yeah, in concrete terms it is. But in terms of expression, it kind of depends on what you're talking about for me personally, because whereas you'll very rarely see characters like, oh, it's okay to love or to marry somebody of their same gender when it comes to like, oh, this person is actually a lesbian. Like, even like a lot of the best gay representation that we get in anime is, well, they can't get married though, because the idea of them getting married is like the stopping point. Even if they say, oh, it's totally okay for them to be in love, or there's nothing wrong with them having sex or whatever, it's like, well, this is the bar. Like, it's a childhood thing, and as an adult you have to accept that you can't actually marry them. Like, that's the thing that the anime has always been kind of behind Western media on. But when it comes to gender expression, even going back decades, like, Japan is way more loosey-goosey on this stuff than a lot of in the West, in terms of, like, it might not even necessarily affect your sexuality, just in terms of, like, men are allowed to wear dresses and it doesn't have to be a joke, and women are allowed to wear pants and it doesn't mean that they're a domineering, you know, any number of stereotypes that we see in the West about this. Like, it's not gender expression doesn't come with this set of rules and gags and stuff like that attached.
Or the same baggage, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot more fluid in Eastern.
There's a manga I'd like to jump in here with, because we were talking about Rose of Versailles, Jason, and you were talking about how it has maybe some trans, but not really specific trans identity. Mm-hmm. Ryoko Ikeda did an even better one-shot manga. It was a one-volume manga. It's never been translated, called Claudine. And if you can, you know what, I never suggest scans. Everybody who knows me knows how much I don't like scans. But if you can, read the scans, because it's a story about a woman. And as you read the story, it can easily be seen both as a trans narrative or as a lesbian narrative. It could be a woman who wants to dress as a man and have agency and have the same equality as a man, be free to love a woman, but it also could be a woman who would like to transition and actually become a man. Because it was done in the 70s, you don't really quite have that level of nuance necessarily in her. But you could easily read it either way, and it would be a completely valid story. And I wish somebody would translate that one volume, because I think it's one of the most amazing one-shot volume mangas that I've ever read. And the fact that it's by Ryoko Ikeda means it has beautiful art and it's super emotional and everybody cries. And of course it has this beautiful, beautiful tragic ending and everything. But it's absolutely a manga worth reading, because it has what is a tremendously modern take on things.
Oh, that's awesome. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, nobody ever has, but I love it. It's fantastic.
That reminds me that Rose of Versailles is actually supposed to come out in English from Udon Entertainment, I think, this year.
Yeah, they said it would be here in the winter, but we're still waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about bad representation, which there's plenty of in anime and manga. And I'm curious what your pet peeves are. What bothers you the most? And conversely, what do you feel like you hear about the most? Because a big component of this is just social media chatter. It's a huge component of this. What do you feel like you hear about the most? Like, what do you consider the worst? What's your pet peeve? And then also, what do you hear about the most? Jacob, why don't we start with you?
In terms of stuff that bugs me, I guess, it's always the, weirdly, the thing that doesn't bug me. So I mentioned, great sissy characters. Something personally that does not bother me is, the idea of gay men being a fet and that being, negative, because, for some people, the idea of, sort of a queenie character, sort of a really queenie sissy gay guy, is inherently bad to them. But interestingly, if you ask a lot of gay men, and of which I am by proxy, that's not really the issue. And it's like, well, wait, are you saying that if I'm gay, that I have to be butch or hetero looking enough to be normal? And it's understandable, like. It's understandable to want a gay male character to not be like a cartoonish queenie stereotype, but at the same time, like, there shouldn't be a pressure to how do I explain this? There shouldn't be a pressure to throw away all the effeminate things that many gay men love to embrace, because they're already out of the closet, so why not? So, you know, think there are lots of girly things that are great. Why can't I embrace this girly thing? Like, I enjoy it, and I love men. I don't understand why this is off limits, or you would find this off putting, and therefore, in order to be a gay character on screen that's good representation to the straights, I have to be like, you know, not effeminate. Anyway. But that's a whole loaded ball of wax. My point is that very queenie characters in anime don't bother me. In fact, I like to see gay characters that have that element to it, and they're not just like, oh, I could be a straight person, but I'm just not. You know, like, it's otherwise identical. However, the issue comes when it's predatory. When it's the character is like, oh, well, being gay means I like small boys and I'm predatory and I don't take no for an answer. Because that's just the projection of, like, whoever's writing that character isn't, they're seeing the girliness as frightening, and they're seeing the girliness as a hallmark of, like, oh, what if men treated me the way that I treat women? and you know, and as that's some sort of scary thing, or it's supposed to be funny, but really it's funny because it's scary. And so that's the thing I see, I guess, in anime most that bothers me is the predatory lesbian or the predatory gay guy. With the predatory lesbian, it usually shows up more in shows that are ostensibly shoujo-ai rather than general audience things. But for the men, it usually shows up like even in kid shows. Like it'll be a normal like show that's aimed at like 10-year-olds in Japan, and that's the something that breaks my heart is that there's one gay character, and you know he's a gay character because he doesn't take no for an answer, and he like harasses people, and it's like, well, that's not okay, like, and that's upsetting to me. So I guess that's the most upsetting thing, because it shows up in the most mainstream kinds of anime, is the predatory gay or lesbian character, I guess.
I have to say that. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was going to say one. The predatory thing is one, but then the pedophilia is the other.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is like, you know, I don't know if this is too controversial to mention, but like I've been bombarded with just people sending me stuff like that gets more and more extreme. And it's like, I, you know, this is not what I want to watch, because, you know, Boku no Pico was like a big thing, and everybody, you know, says it as if it's like this big joke that people must watch and we must get a laugh out of it. But that shit is nasty. If you've ever seen even just a little bit of stuff like that, it's like unbelievably disgusting. And I don't know how stuff like that gets greenlit. Talking about it makes me uncomfortable. I don't know. Are any of you familiar with it?
Yeah, huh? It's a meme. Not. That's a meme at this point.
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with
yet.
Well, it's okay.
Just don't.
I would suggest just Googling it. It's pretty much a small, you know, short miniseries about a pedophilic relationship between two young boys, and it's all that stuff, it just blows me. And now it's like you said, it's become a meme at this point, and that's kind of not what I don't think that the weird section of anime, I don't think that's what that should represent.
Well,
you know,
I would argue, I would make the argument that that's an extreme and very fringe case. You're talking about a tiny subgenre of porn for a particular disgusting ass
ladies, right?
Group of ladies that I don't like. That's a tiny sub. Like, we are generally speaking about stuff that shows up on Crunchyroll and in, you know, Best Buy. Like, we're talking about, right, you know, non-explicitly pornographic anime.
Like, the number of Boku no Pico was produced for and purchased by, like, literally maybe hundreds of people.
Yeah.
And the fact that it is, like, it is direct-to-video marked as pornography for a very specific and tiny audience. The fact that we've heard of it over here and it became such a meme is because because there is a large subset of people who go out of their way to find the weirdest and craziest shit so they can go, oh, Japan, and we know what that's like.
Yeah, it's literally a fortune
wacky
thing.
Japan, yeah.
Yeah. It's a mischaracterization as like, oh, Japan's crazy and weird, and we know as anime fans that gets old. It's like it's this attempt to go, oh, this is really, you know, like look how wacky and perverted the Japanese are. And it's just, you know, it's an uncomfortable kind of crappy thing that we have to deal with as fans, certainly, but it's not representative of what kind of media gets made and viewed by most people in Japan.
Okay.
You could cut my part out then.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's an important thing. It's an important thing to mention, and it's an important thing to talk about, and it's good to contextualize it this way.
And it's not like, when I brought up the predatory thing, like, it's not like that isn't a huge part of it. Like, it is usually like, even in, it's not explicitly or pornographic, but they are usually preying on like a younger kid. Like a very big anime that was seen like by a lot of people, Gurren Lagann, like has a central character who specifically pervs on younger boys a lot of the time.
Yeah, which that kind of, I'm like, man.
Yeah, he's like, what is this doing here? You know,
but you get that all the time in BL. I don't want to say all the time, but the whole predatory semi thing in BL with the, you know, cute innocent uke who's powerless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is so. It's honestly the one thing that puts me off most BL stories. I mean, there's things that I read that I'm like, wow, this is really good. But I find so many people really get into that, and they get into it. I'm not a fan of the predatory thing either, particularly when it's a power issue. For me, the issue is and I joke about this all the time on Okazu, because I like characters that beat the crap out of each other, but I like when everything's on equal footing. So as crappy and horrible as Ikitosen is, which is like one of the most crappy, horrible things I've ever watched, all the characters are on equal footing, so they're beating the crap out of each other on equal footing. So all the guys and the women are all beating the crap out of each other equally. And as opposed to a story where, like, even in Strawberry Panic, where particularly in the light novels, you have the main character who is completely innocent. She is a seal waiting to be clubbed. Ugh. And she's immediately glommed on by, like, the playgirl of the school. And so she's supposed to be overwhelmed and awed. And as soon as you get to that thing, there's a manga coming out this year from Yen Press called Mercy Alago. And they've been advertising it as an action manga. And I want to warn you all that it is, in fact, not an action manga. It is sold in Japan as a violence yuri manga. And it is extremely violent. I love it. I mean, I think it's fantastic. The main character is a psychotic lesbian. She has completely weird lesbian sex, and the violence is just through the roof. And as I always describe to people in one of the volumes, there's an issue where one of the women characters, is meat hooked through the chest, and that was not the most disgusting thing that happened in that volume.
So is it like S&M, you mean? It's like sexual?
No, it's just straight up violence. I mean, it's like the first chapter is some guy who's like, he's weirded out on steroids and he's ripping innocent bystanders in half and their guts are hanging out. So it's like complete Guro stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's not sexualized Guro, it's just complete horrible violence. But it also is a lesbian character, and she is genuinely lesbian. She has lesbian sex throughout the story. And I really like the manga. But the deal is that there's a couple of volumes where we veer into a territory where little girls, young women, are being victimized. And as soon as we veer right off the line of completely equal people capable of violence at equal levels to victimization, I check out.
Yeah, and I feel like that's the thing where, like, if you watch enough stuff, and you know, like Jacob and I work at ANN, and we cover dozens of shows every season, and there's a ton of this stuff. Your instinct for what that is, what the line is, becomes honed very quickly. And like, I feel I know when I'm watching something.
The second.
Like, we just had this happen with interviews with Monster Girls.
Uh-huh.
You can tell they're walking close to that line.
Right.
And then you can tell right away. It's like, oh, this could go down a bad road. And then it did.
It necessarily didn't,
but it is edging ever closer to the creep line.
Uh-huh.
And you just, like, you know instantly. And I feel like with representation in this, it's kind of the same. It's not a knee-jerk reaction, but you've seen enough stuff to know where it's going 99% of the time.
Yeah, and what's particularly interesting about Interviews with Monster Girls is that it really illustrates the complexity what's the line, and what do you consider valuable representation, or something that speaks to you or has a valuable message or relatable content, versus what puts you off? Because sometimes those things are kind of, they cohabitate. Because Interviews with Monster Girls, you have this show doesn't necessarily have LGBT representation in it, although it has, like, certainly subtext. But it is, like, very directly about intersectionality and progressive issues. Like, the whole, this species is a stand-in for racism or whatever thing is extremely tired, and it doesn't usually play out well. But Interviews with Monster Girls specifically goes the route of talking about intersectionality as a concept, using Monster Girls, rather than just saying, oh, this is a stand-in for, you know, a race or a persecuted group of people. It's talking about the very issue of identity politics and progressive attitudes to take, which is interesting. And so, but that exists alongside the issue of, okay, but this is a fantasy for the guy who is the self-insert, and all the monster girls are secretly in love with him. Like, that is an issue. But so those two things are, like, existing at the same time. So one, you can take offense to one and be like, oh, well, this was completely unnecessary. You didn't have to have them all be in love with him, especially when a lot of them are high school girls. And, well, this is actually a really thoughtful take on how you addressed representation and interaction with somebody who's of a minority group that is not you, that kind of a thing. Like, all that stuff is really thoughtful and really kind of has its head in the right place.
I find that there's a lot of series like that, though, that they layer both of those things. So it's like, look, Sakura Trek came out a few years ago.
Right.
And, you know, the cinematography, as it were, was thigh staring. We obsessively stare at the edges of the girls' skirts and then their laps, and it really creeped me out, and I couldn't watch it. But on the other hand, the characters are openly love and all the people around them. And admittedly, there are no adults and no families and no life and no society. There's only the school. Mm-hmm. So it's all the girls in their school, but they're all really supportive and they get it, you know, you and Haruka in love and everybody's all happy for them. And that's the actual sum of the story is how nice.
Right.
I'm staring
at their asses the entire time, which is just really vexing.
Yeah.
A lot of anime and manga especially, it's interesting to try to pick apart what I mean. It's like peeling apart the layers of an onion or something, right? There's the artist's intention, and there's what the artist likes, and then there's what the editor maybe wants them to do. Like maybe the show is fetishy and has this pervy element because the editor is like pushing them. Like the shonen audience will love this, or maybe it's in all the author's works and the author is the perv. But then there's how the audience relates to it as well. You know, because like you said, you could pick something. I mean, you know, you can look at, depending on the ratio of positive or negative, you can pick out, you know, you can pick the gem out of the heap of shit, or you can or the reverse, right? Or the smell of that shit can be enough to put you off what would otherwise be a delightful manga dinner, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, and that's actually, I think, a really key point, Jason, because when you're talking about representation, and this is the big question, because this is what you asked on Twitter, how do LGBTQ people feel about representation? And, of course, when you generalize a group, the answer is going to be it's unanswerable. Everybody feels differently. But last spring, I had the tremendous pleasure of being invited out to Japan during Gay Pride Week, Rainbow Pride Week in Tokyo. And I was able to do a lecture. And I was alongside Nakamura Kiyo and Tagami Gengoro. And we were talking to an audience that was specifically there as part of Rainbow Pride. So these are all people who are identifying for this moment as people being interested in LGBTQ issues, talking about comics and talking about the history of LGBTQ comics, as well as Yuri and BL, which are not always entirely the sort of a Venn diagram on LGBTQ and Yuri and BL. And the audience there is as hungry and as nuanced as we are. So, you know, the answer is there's no answer to how do people feel, but each individual person is going to find different things. And I can share this with you. Tagami Sensei has a book in Japan, which is coming out in English this summer from a gay manga and IDW. I think it was IDW, but it's called My Brother's Husband. And mm-hmm. It's the most important manga of the last 5 years, 10 years maybe. It is a gay story that runs in a mainstream men's manga magazine there, Action Comics. So it's being sold to adult straight men who read a manga magazine. And it's about a gay man from Canada who goes to Japan and tries to learn about the youth of his late husband's life. And it's incredibly touching, and I'm going to go down like this is, if you have never read a gay manga ever in your life and you have no interest in reading a manga about gay people, read this manga when it comes out. It's called My Brother's Husband. And it's just really excellent. And the question, of course, for Tagami Sensei was, well, how are the straight men dealing with it? How are they dealing with it? He said most of the people he gets mail from is very positive, except for the ones that aren't. And that's really the answer. You know, but he says he gets a lot of really positive feedback about it. So I think that's really paradigms changing.
Yeah, I've absolutely seen a recent shift, at least just in terms of manga, like anime. Well, you know, you sort of say Yuri on Ice as a thing that was wildly successful is kind of a hallmark of, oh, there's definitely been a shift in public opinion on whether LGBT stuff is okay, you know, in like in Japan at large, not just within like the subsets of girls who are fetishizing gay men or men who are fetishizing gay women. Like it is a thing mainstream. Yuri Nice is kind of a good illustrator, but also just in terms of manga, like there is two things that jump to mind immediately. Like there is a major, I don't remember the title of it because the people talking about it, but there were people talking about it very excitedly. It's a major thing that's running in Shonen Jump. It's a long-running shonen thing where the main character is intersex, and this is not part of the premise. It was revealed fairly recently, just in the middle of a plot arc, that the main character is intersex and doesn't really have a gender identity. Is kind of unsure of what to do about it. Like,
wow,
yeah, I don't know the name of it. I feel so bad. Somebody will have to find it and look it up. But that's a thing running in a major magazine, and it's. And it's apparently the reception to it has been good from what the interviews with the author have stated, and then there's another there's a basketball manga that like won a major award or something about it, that about a women's basketball team, and one of the characters is openly a trans man on the women's basketball team, and it's stuff like that where it's like, oh, this is and when I say won a major award, I don't just mean like like a Wandering Sun or Aoi Hana kind of a thing where it has a niche audience. Like this is again like a manga that is read by a wider, like sort of mainstream kind of audience rather than a specific, oh, this is BL or this is Yuri. So there's been, I think, a shift certainly in public opinion or just desire to talk about these issues in at least Japanese media that I've seen.
Well, I will say that with the stuff like Aoi Hana and Wandering Sun, those are written for a magazine that doesn't target the same kind of niche, which is sort of an interesting side conversation we can have one day, because Manga Erotics F and Comic Beam are for adults who read comics, period. And there's, I jokingly refer to it as the fifth column, because they're not like a niche group, but they are a niche, of people who are not otaku per se, but are comics fans. Yeah, there's actually also another manga. Hang on a second. I just want to pull this up here. It's called Shimanami Tasugare, which is also running in a fairly major men's magazine. And it's about a gay teenager, a local gay teen who moves to a small like seaside community. And there's a lesbian couple in that town and they become friendly. And so he has society. He has someone to talk to. He has mentors, that kind of thing. And that's running in a fairly majorish magazine. So I think it is starting to bleed through the cracks.
Well, we didn't quite get Jason's or Valerie's representation you've seen that bothers you the most, sort of pet peeves. And what you hear, what you feel like you hear about the most. Jason, could you get to that one?
Well, I mean, I dislike, they aren't so common anymore, but I dislike the occasional representation of sort of these comedic drag queens. And I mean, I don't have a problem with drag queens as a thing, but I dislike these sort of jokey sort of, you know, guy with a wig and, you know, 5 o'clock shadow that you'll occasionally see, and not really so much as major characters, but, you know, you'll occasionally see them as side comedy characters, right? And that, you know, that annoys me.
Right. Yeah, it's still relatively common. You still see that every now and then.
Yeah.
Not as often, maybe.
I would draw, yeah, for me, I draw the line in, like, oh, I like this effeminate character, or oh, I don't, when you mentioned the 5 o'clock shadow, that's kind of a hallmark. So if a character is just sort of frequently cross-dressing and very, like, say the straight cross-dressing deuteragonist in Princess Jellyfish, or if he's not straight, he's at least bi or something, but he's not, like, a gay character, he just likes the women's clothing, you know, and, yeah. And stuff like that. So that character or other characters where, yes, it is played for laughs that he's so effeminate, but you are laughing with him versus something like the completely bizarre and out of left field and completely unnecessary episode of Gargantia of the Verdurous Planet where the main character runs into a den of cross-dressing men who are what, as you mentioned, like, they go out of their way to give them linebacker shoulders and a huge 5 o'clock shadow and like makeup that's supposed to make them grotesque and frightening to you. And so, yeah, like I mean, like, as much as I love, you know, good Queenie characters, like, the line is usually drawn when you can see in this in anime, because it's very easy to denote this visually, like, they choose to draw a very thick 5 o'clock shadow on somebody is usually, like, an indicator of, oh, we are not laughing with this character, we are laughing at this character.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I mean, normally, and this was something that surprised me when I first saw anime and manga, because coming out of, you know, the culture of the 80s and 90s, where any kind of androgyny was like, oh, this sucks, huh? You know, like, it's all totally homophobic. The depiction of any kind of, like, good or beautiful or attractive androgyny was really rare. You know, that isn't the whole answer, of course, but I definitely, when you do see the sort of more Western style, like bad, funny / scary androgyny depicted in anime and manga, that's annoying. I mean, but of course, I mean, obviously anime and manga has, you know, other, many stereotypes, which, you know, are deprecated in the West, which still, you know, pop up, unfortunately, in anime and manga. And that's a larger question.
So
I agree with Jason. That's my pet peeve, yeah, as well. The heavy 5 o'clock shadow, the most recent depiction of that character that annoys the crap out of me is Puri Puri Prisoner from One Punch Man. Mm. It makes me want to throw myself out of the first floor window when I just see, you know, every time I see that character come on screen, and it's the big muscles and it's the huge 5 o'clock shadow, but it's the mascara, you know, and the pink prison garb or whatever. And it's twofold, where it's sort of, it becomes not a joke anymore. And it just sort of makes prison life seem like this, you know, this big cross-dressing disco party, when it's just totally... I don't know. That's just sort of the impression that I got from it. I don't know. I think my thinking is kind of weird on it, but it really bothered me. I haven't quite been able to verbalize how I really feel about the character, but it just annoyed me on so many different levels. I'm like, that's not what jail is like. That's not what these, you know, people like that are like. They don't all, you know, have muscles and 5 o'clock shadows. It's just a really poor representation.
Yeah, that was
and it looks ugly a lot of the time too. Just aesthetically, it just doesn't look good.
And it's meant to look ugly. And I think that's part of the really offensive bit. In One Piece, there's an island of cross-dressers, and all of them are meant to look absolutely caricature-like, and they're all the head of them, Ivankov, who's the queen, is a great character, but they're all meant to be appalling. And it's very tiresome.
And that stuff can be a pitfall for general audiences, and not just LGBT audiences as well. Because if it's bad enough, like it is in One Punch Man. One Punch Man is one of the more egregious things I've seen, because One Punch Man was a pretty big mainstream hit in terms of anime and how mainstream it can get over here. And so when we reached Puri Puri Prisoner, it was like it was a bit of a shock. It was like, oh, I was enjoying this like without any caveats.
You hit a speed
and
bump.
And suddenly, I have a caveat.
Tiger
like
and
a
Bunny.
Major caveat.
Tiger and Bunny.
Yeah. Tiger and Bunny isn't as bad as Puri Puri Prisoner.
Dude, like, it's the same big speed bump.
It's a problem.
I remember watching the first episode
it's a
of Tiger
problem,
and Bunny.
But
yeah.
It's a problem. I'm just saying it's Puri Puri Prisoner is so much worse, is all I'm saying.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
it
has
even
the
later.
Whole. Okay, I mean, while I'm comparing bad things, I would say that Puri Puri is worse because it carries not only the like really negative Queenie stereotype, but it also has the prison rape stereotype. So mm-hmm. That is just bad. That's right. Just bad.
He's
just
not
generally
just a queen. He's
really
specifically
bad.
A prison rapist. Like that is.
Yeah,
the
I wasn't
joke.
Saying Tiger and Bunny was worse. I was just saying otherwise perfectly fine show that you hit this big speed bump on. It's like, what was that?
Oh no.
Yeah.
Also,
I have one more pet peeve, and that's something that's it's fairly specific. I doubt not to Yuri, but I think to things that are associated with for women. There's a Yuri manga coming out called Citrus that I no longer review on Okazu, and I will have other people who've read volumes of it. Nobody ever looks happy. I cannot stand my entertainment when it's not entertaining. You know, I'm not asking for every story not to be a tearjerker or something. I mean, certainly like Rose of Versailles, everyone cries all the time. But it's beautiful, and it's tragic, and it's epic. And in Citrus, it's an abusive relationship that's really uncomfortable, and it's not nuanced enough to make sense of any of the abusive elements. and everyone's miserable all the time. And I just can't get behind that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it seems like it's coming. Like, stuff like that always feels to me like it's being written from a place where the person really doesn't understand or maybe doesn't have a good attitude towards this stuff.
Because I agree.
Like, yeah, like, it doesn't feel like this is speaking to the community. It feels like it's trying to show people how miserable everyone in the community is, which isn't true at all.
Yeah,
It's a shitty old projection stereotype.
Yeah, you can't be gay and happy at the same time if you want to if you want to appeal to straight audiences. Knowledge of like the 80s and 90s.
This one's a manga that's written in a Yuri magazine for a Yuri audience, and so and it's inexplicably popular. And the only reason I can think is back to a point that you made earlier, I think, Jake, about it could be the editor trying to shove that in there. But the thing that I just don't get is nobody is made happy by the relationship, and yet we're focusing on it, and it's mutually destructive. But there's not enough nuance to explain why this is a bad thing. There's nobody. It goes back. I have a lot of things about not having society, because in your real life, even if you're in a new relationship and it's really weird and freaky, you usually have friends outside that relationship that you talk to.
Yeah.
Nobody has any friends.
I mean, that's a problem with I see in Yaoi too. I mean, I think maybe it's just a bad economy of story, right? I mean, it's very isolated, you know? It's this claustrophobic situation where there's two characters and maybe one rival, you know? I don't know if it's just bad storytelling or what.
It is specific. In the case of Yaoi, like, I can't speak to Yuri. That's a demographic I don't know as well. But in the case of Yaoi, it is by design. The idea is that the characters aren't even gay, usually. Like, they say it's only for you or whatever. They're like, oh, I'm only in love with you. And it is a projection scenario where the female reader is picking a character that they project themselves into in this sort of, like, dramatic, a little too violent, and extremely intimate. Like, the sad thing is, like, perceived to be more intimate than heterosexual relationship would be able to be. But it's basically a heterosexual relationship with two men in it that is, because it's two men, separated into the world of this sort of pseudo-pornographic fantasy, away from all reality and any outside forces that would, like, have to put it in the context of consequences to anything, whether it be a public gay relationship or the fact that abuse is going on. Any of that it's all separated out, which is fine for pornography, but it doesn't, you know, pornography is its own thing. It doesn't really work as a narrative that's supposed to speak on a level beyond a fantasy for a specific group of people with a fetish.
Mizuguchi Yakiko does research on BL, and she talks about that a lot, about how for some women, reading BL is like a shared erotic, public erotic experience. So in the same way that, like, straight guys might go to, like, a strip club.
Right.
It's a shared, completely non-homosexual, shared erotic situation. So you have a bunch of guys, they're all watching women. So there's no homoeroticism. We're all focused on the women. Mm-hmm. In some sense, BL can be a shared, like, you go to, like, YaoiCon, and you've got people who are all sharing the excitement and the sexual excitement of being interested in BL and masking themselves into these BL relationships, but there's no assumed homosexuality.
Right, which is
for themselves. It becomes a safe sexual space.
Yeah, which is why, like, mostly I'm very familiar with Yaoi because, as well as growing up with a lot of friends who later came out as lesbians, I grew up with a lot of, many of them, actually the same people, grew up with a lot of friends that were really into Yaoi, and so I sat through a lot of it, and I wasn't really crazy about it, but, like, I didn't know why, because, I mean, I was barely coming around to the idea that, oh, being gay isn't a sin with the way that I was raised and stuff like that. But I wasn't really sure what bothered me about this, but I think what jumped out to me was that a lot of these girls, obviously they hadn't come out of the closet yet either, some of the ones I'm thinking about, but, like, they were also anti-gay, but they were really into Yaoi, and it was like those two things could exist at the same time because it's so far removed from a reality of normalizing a gay relationship that you could be, like, anti-gay and also like buy a lot of yaoi manga and be really in- and find it really sexy. And I was, you know, so that kind of.
Well, that actually is a really good point, because this is something we talk about a lot on Okazu and Yurikon, is that people who were the traditional audiences of BL and Yuri, which were straight members of the opposite sex of, so, you know, straight women reading BL and straight men reading Yuri, weren't for a long time, weren't really pro-gay issues at all. Mm-hmm. They often were very anti-gay issues when it came to voting, and they were disinterested in the mainstream. And I know when I was in Japan last spring, talking to a lot of women who were there at the event, a lot of them were BL fans, and even the straight women who were are BL fans seemed to be leading a quiet little revolution about that, where there seems to be more of a push towards, if you like this, you might also want to think about occasionally supporting LGBTQ issues as well.
Right.
But traditionally, that was always assumed that the straight men reading Yuri porn were clearly uninterested in lesbians as human beings.
Yeah.
They were simply, you know, jerk-off material. And the same thing would be, in fact, true about the straight women who were masking themselves into BL because they were there for the fantasy sexuality, not really for the fact that there were anything like that. There was a story years ago in The Advocate. I mean, it was 100 million years ago. And the woman who was buying Yaoi Doujinshi and bringing it to New York. And so the article was about her as this, about Doujinshi and about her. And the line that she said, and I will never forget this, she said she liked Yaoi Doujinshi because the men were clean like pets. Right. And I was as clean and smooth like pets, and I just thought, oh my God, I cannot.
Well, you know, I mean, just on Twitter the other, not too long ago, there was some dude was saying the same thing about Moe, right? You know, like, oh, it's like this love you feel for a little animal, you know? I mean, it's, yeah.
This allows me to fully dehumanize them.
Right, yeah, right. Just the old, you know.
Well, you know, that's not that far with all the animal-eared little girls that they have.
There we go, yeah. Cat boys and cat girls.
Well, exactly.
Like love pistols. That's a, you know, that's a BL.
So we should talk a little bit. So before we wrap, we should talk a bit about, because the tenor that I've gotten from this conversation is that in general, things do appear, at least now we're talking about a wide array of stuff, a big industry, a lot of consumers, a lot of different types of readers and artists, a lot of different type of material to assign a blanket statement to this without much nuance is worthless and only will get a bunch of arguments going. But I would argue you could generally characterize the direction anime and manga is going in due to social changes in Japan, certainly due to purchasing habits, as we've seen recently, that the attitudes that we're seeing reflected in manga and anime are getting better,
They seem to be to me. I mean, you certainly...
I think getting quite better, is exactly right, though.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's no concrete one way or the other. It's hard to say, but, like, it is hard to see the success of Yuri on Ice as something that could have
just
been
a fluke. Just a fluke. The real anime fans were watching Symphogear. Okay?
Right. It's hard to see as something that could have been replicated even 10 years ago.
Yeah,
and where it's like, I don't think this could have come out with to such like relatively mainstream fanfare. Like, I can't even say relatively mainstream because now this thing is selling about as well as Mr. Osamatsu, which is considered basically mainstream in Japan.
Yep.
So it's like, well, okay, this is a big deal, and it explicitly has an engagement a romantic engagement between two dudes.
Yuri on Ice is, in many ways, kind of doing the same thing that Utena did in its first 60 seconds, which is, yep. I'm a prince, fuck you.
Right.
Yuri on Ice is like, we're in love, fucking deal with it. Like,
right.
It doesn't ever question it. It presents it as, hey, this is normal, it exists. It's not even making really that... like big and overt statement about
no,
it.
It's just
like presenting you a world in which this doesn't fucking matter at all, and it's beautiful.
Right.
But it's kind of the same thing you tend to...
Right. Yeah. Well,
it's a little similar.
Yeah.
And there's always
series that are sort of genre defining, even when the genre's already been defined, and they redefine things. And I think this is definitely one of those.
I just want to point out that I think one of the reasons that Yuri on Ice. One of the many reasons that Yuri on Ice penetrated as far as it did, in similar to Utena, that expression, that particular feeling, hey, this is, no one cares, it's just normal, mm-hmm. is what everybody wants to hear, mm-hmm. and the world everyone wants to live in.
Right.
And, like, so that is a beautiful thing. And when you see it, people really react to it, mm-hmm. like, oh, shit. Right.
Like, wow, this can be a thing. Wouldn't and that's nice really the ultimate really fantasy, like, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is. It's like this idea where everything that you thought was special and out of reach and amazing and, oh, my God, how could that ever be? And then all of a sudden it's there and everyone goes, yeah, cool.
Yeah. So,
and that's the life we're all living, right? We're living that life. We're living the life where it's like we are who we are. And everyone around us goes, cool. That's cool. Yeah. There's still a lot of people who don't have that. And I think something like Urianis could really, or Utena, or, you know, just some, a lot of the series like Strawberry Panic, all the things that I consider like gateways, because every few years you get each genre kind of gets its own gateway. I think Otota no Oto, which is My Brother's Husband, is going to be a huge gateway for people who had no idea that manga could represent an actual gay man story and not be also trying to be a fantasy for somebody.
Yeah, and what comes to mind, also, there's, you know, now award-winning manga, like, won a lot of accolades and then has been made into an anime adaptation that is definitely aimed at the prestige piece crowd, Showa Genroku Rakugo Shinju. And it's, you know, like, they don't directly say it, but it's very impossible to watch that show and not like, it's not impossible, but you won't really understand what's going on unless you watch that show and go, oh, this guy's whole problem is that he's firmly in the closet and he's determined to drag everybody down.
And it's the
down. 70s. Right. Well, no, it's the 70s when he's 70. Prior to that, it's like the 40s and he's 20.
Which,
you know,
gives the show a meta narrative about what it was like to be gay in those years.
Yeah, or trans. We don't know. We don't know whether he's gay or trans. We have no idea but he's got issues. And but my point is, like, so that's if you're interested in very serious anime and manga, like, that's a huge thing in Japan right now. Like, it is a very, like, serious work that's gotten a lot of, like, you know, chin-stroking accolades. But if you were to look at the author's other work, like, literally all of her other work, apart from this masterpiece that she's penned, and it is a masterpiece. I haven't seen the end, but up to this point, it's been shockingly good. The rest of her work is all BL. Like, it's all, and specifically, it's pretty good BL, actually. Like, it's thoughtful and, like, it's porn, but it's, like, good pornography. And it's, like, so it's interesting to see that as another, like, example of, like, oh, these are gateways into, like, deep wells of, like, of LGBTQ, like, variation and strangeness. Like, some of her work does have, like, trans characters in it, has intersex characters, has a myriad of unusual fetishes and specific types of relationships. It's not, like, she doesn't do the Seme Anuke type BL, or if she did, it's one of many, many things that she does. And somebody might come to it and maybe learn what an intersex person is by watching Showa Genroku Rakugo Shinju and then looking at her porn and going, oh, intersex, I've never heard of this, what is this? You know, so, you know.
Well, one nice thing about the BL market is it's an easy to get into market for a lot of women creators, you know, and some of them just do sort of mediocre porn, and some go on to do really amazing things like SDM or Fumi Yoshinaga. I also am very fond of Hinako Takanaga's BL as well.
Right. Right. Okay. If I were to go around and say, like, hey, what's the best LGBT representation you've seen in anime and manga recently? Like, what's the best one you've seen lately? Is everyone's answer the same, or do we have other... does anyone have anything to say on this other than Yuri on Ice?
For me, it's Otota no Oto.
Right. You've sold me on this manga. I'm definitely going to read it.
Yeah, no, sorry, but it's it's one of those things that hasn't got over here yet, and I literally can't wait because I think it's going to it's going to blow people's heads.
I didn't know it existed. It sounds like it's ripe for a mediocre live action adaptation and a really good and
it's,
a really good
exactly,
live action.
Because it's much too adult. It's not for the children. It's not for the hardcore otaku. It's an actual, really sincere, a really beautifully presented, sincere story about a gay man. So I don't think it would make the most boring anime ever.
But Yuri on Ice was huge. Mm-hmm. So if that's a really popular manga, there's probably maybe an anime coming.
Right. I mean, Scum's maybe. Wish is currently being adapted, and Scum's Wish is not exactly like a
Scum's Wish has a crowd pleaser. Okay, give me a break. Scum's Wish has a lurid premise that you would pull people in with. This sounds like it absolutely
does
not.
It does have a lurid premise, but I meant that it was a popular manga and it is a misery wallow. Like it is a but not in a shallow way. It's a complex misery wallow, and it has a lesbian character in it. So,
Valerie, would you have you seen anything recently besides Yuri on Ice? Maybe.
Not recently, no. I've my focus has been elsewhere, unfortunately.
Right.
And I don't want to talk about it because that's like opening up another can of worms. But my focus has been elsewhere. But Yuri on Ice has been pretty good. I also enjoyed Free. I thought Free was pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's about it right now.
Yeah. I mean, Jacob, Free, how do you feel about that?
Free is candy, which is good. Like I don't the characters aren't actually.
It hasn't come up yet, which is why.
Right. Yeah. Well, so to talk about Free, I feel like you have to talk about K-On! Because we don't see a lot of this, but it is it's just moe for girls in the purest sense possible. Like it is in terms of this is guilt-free.
Which I think is also important. It's important that that exists.
Yeah.
And the reaction to it was extremely telling.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like, extremely telling.
Right.
It's not like, that we didn't already know that, but it was nice to have it proven, I guess.
Right. Well, but I guess my point is, like, to me it doesn't speak as representation because it is both purely escapist and not canonical. Like, so you have, like, stuff that's canonical but also... but also escapist, like Yaoi, and then you have stuff I'm trying to find a way to explain this that's concise.
Can I say something here?
Yes, like, please.
I would put Free. It's not that it's like this is really awesome LGBT representation that gay people themselves will see themselves in,
yes,
and the situation
not,
will feel relatable. But gay men appreciate Magic Mike.
Uh-huh.
And you're Free is nothing if not Magic Mike.
Right.
And Magic Mike is
and I just
want
to say that's like,
but
I don't want you to think that I thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. That's
no,
not what I meant.
No, we're just discussing Free.
Really, you know, I just thought it was really cool that, you know, sort of the direction they went with it and how, especially young girls, how they took to it and stuff like that when I traveled the convention scene. I'm like, let me check this out. And then I watched it. I was like, oh, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's not, you know, be all end all, but I thought it was interesting, you know, the way that it went. So.
Well, I think
absolutely.
I think like it's important to point out that like Magic Mike, it is sex. It's sex positive. Mm-hmm. Like Free is not gross. It is not ugly. It is not the characters don't abuse each other. Mm-hmm. It is a positive, forward facing show that is generally just positive qualities.
Right. It normalizes. I guess the nicest thing about it is that it, while moe for men starring women, like moe that's all about girls starring women, like there's not an assumption that, and the reason I think we get less moe for women, moe for men, like there's no hurdle to overcome with intimate relationships between women. Like they're best friends and maybe they'll kiss, you know, kind of a thing with moe is not a surprise because like women are allowed to be much more intimate in their friendships than men are. So I think for Free, it's nice that it normalizes to young teenage girls who are just getting into anime or anybody who watches it that intimate friendships between men are normal and okay and heartwarming and good, even if there's not actually a gay element there, except in the imaginations of those who might watch it. It is positive on that level of like reinforcing that like intimacy between guys is fine regardless of any like sexual connotation. It's freeing on that level. Which is good. So, like, I, you know, that's one of the nice things about moe for women is that it, you know, is that it breaks down those machismo barriers that we see and characterize and even like shonen friendships. Oh, I love you because I hit you in the face or whatever. And it's like free. No, they're just like really, really honest and intimate with one another, you know, in a bonding kind of way.
Right. Okay. Well, I think that actually, I think that just about wraps us up. I can't thank you all for coming by to talk about this today. I feel like that was a pretty good discussion. Mm-hmm. Thank you all
for having us.
Yeah, Erica, thanks for coming by. Jason, Valerie, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate having you here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Okay, we are no longer recording. Okay, that's our show. Huge thanks to Erica, Jason, and Valerie for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, you know, all those places. Leave us a rating, a review. We would really appreciate it. And I'll see you all next time.